The second case for oral argument this morning is Hall et al. Versus State of South Dakota and the Department of Transportation of the State of South Dakota. For the appellant Hall, we have Mr. Jeffrey Hurd, an attorney from Rapid City, who I understand will be speaking first for 10 minutes and then for 5 minutes on the rebuttal. Is that correct, Mr. Hurd?
Yes, sir.
Then also we have Mr. Brian Blazer from Boston, and you'll be speaking second for 10 minutes and then second in the rebuttal for 5 minutes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Very well. And then Ms. Carl Engel is representing the State of South Dakota. She's an assistant attorney general from Pierre, correct? Okay, Mr. Hurd, you may proceed, sir, and you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. This is a story which has a happy ending for South Dakota, and I'm here in the hope that it will have a happy ending for my clients. Ellsworth Air Force Base is a very important economic engine in western South Dakota, second largest employer in the state of South Dakota. As we all know, the Base Closure Commission and the Pentagon have been looking at ways to reduce costs by closing bases. It became well known in the early 90s that Ellsworth was on that potential list. And the Air Force came out with a list of criteria that it would use for purposes of determining whether or not to retain or close a base. One of the criteria for Air Force bases was encroachment of non-conforming uses into the accident potential zones off of runways. My client's property sits between I-90 and the north end of the main Ellsworth runway at the location where Exit 66 used to sit. In 1995, in an effort to find ways to save Ellsworth and secure its future, a joint land use study was commissioned for the purposes of trying to figure out how do we get rid of these non-conforming uses in these accident potential zones. It was followed in 1996, but that was 1995, I'm sorry. It was followed in 1996 by the Interchange Justification Study. Both of these studies suggested that the best way to get rid of those commercial developments in that area and to prevent future commercial developments from coming there was to remove the exits at 66, thereby depriving those businesses of access to the interstates. In 2003, those exits were in fact removed. The Department of Transportation representatives acknowledged in their depositions that it was done for the purpose of eliminating those non-conforming uses and rendering the land unfit for future non-conforming uses that would otherwise threaten the future of Ellsworth. And indeed, the Circuit Court, in granting summary judgment to the state, acknowledged that that was in fact probably the purpose. The question before the court is it compensable? There are three ways in which the state acts under its supreme authority. Taxation, eminent domain, and police power. Just about everything that the state does falls within one of those three categories. This is not a taxation case. The question in this case is it an eminent domain case, or is it a police power case? And if it's a police power case, is it the kind of police power case for which compensation is due? I believe that there are two roads that lead us to compensation in this case. The first is the question of whether or not this is a taking. If the intent of the government is to damage property, as it is here, the intention here was not to adjust traffic. The intention here was not to either increase safety or convenience for the traveling public. The purpose was to deprive this land of its value for its the existing uses and to prevent it from being used for those uses in the future.
Mr. Hurd, after Lingle, how much stock can we put in this argument about the state's purpose here? It seems to me that they've somewhat suggested that the governmental interest or purpose isn't necessarily controlling anymore.
I think that is true only to a limited extent. I think that what they said is that the test that had been set forth in Agins, but that's a police power test, one. but that that factor isn't going to be considered. I think for our purposes, if we look at, let me think here, Rapid City versus Boland, which is a South Dakota case, and in South Dakota, what the Supreme Court in Rapid City versus Boland said is this: if the destruction of a property interest is intentional, if it is purposeful, that if the action is designed to take or damage, compensation is due in all but three instances: during actual warfare, in the case of an imminent public catastrophe, or in the case of abating a public nuisance. They can come in and tear down a building. Clearly it's a taking. Clearly it was intended to damage that property. But if it was if it's a nuisance, then you have to flip over to decide, you have to flip over to decide whether or not police power analysis applies.
But in a regulatory taking, can we still consider purpose?
I think we still consider purpose under the analysis in Hurley as well. Now, I'm just talking now about the South Dakota law on the subject. I'll defer to, and I'll certainly try to answer the question as best I can, but I would defer to Mr. Blazer on the Fifth Amendment analysis.
That would be fine.
Okay.
And I have a question on the, you argue that the purpose was to get rid of these non-conforming uses. Is that a material fact that was agreed upon? The problem I have when I look through the record, I can't tell what the undisputed material facts are. And my question is, maybe there should have been more testimony and some actual findings of fact and conclusions of law as opposed to a summary judgment motion.
And if the question turns upon intent, and as I'll get to later, I don't necessarily believe that it does. But if it does, and the court does not believe that the record is sufficient to find as a matter of law that this is compensable on that basis, then it should be returned to the trial court for a trial court actual determination of the purpose for which, if compensability turns upon factual findings, those factual findings should be resubmitted to the trial court for that purpose.
To follow up on that question, what about the reasonableness of the denial of access under state law, under our state cases? It seems to me that's one of the elements here. And the trial court made no finding about how unreasonable or reasonable this circuity of access might be.
And I agree. As a consequence, I believe summary judgment in that case is inappropriate. Our motion, there were two motions for summary judgment. We made a motion for partial summary judgment alleging straight out this is a taking. If the government, the government in this case didn't want to pay for it, so it found a unique way to take, but that was its intention. The Department of Transportation acknowledged that was its intention. The Joint Land Use Study and the Interchange Justification Study say that that's its intention. And so we took the position that if that is established and undisputed, we're entitled to a determination that it is a taking. To the extent that it is a police power question, then circuity of travel does become an issue. And if we look at the Boehm versus Bax case out of North Dakota, they talk about the fact that you have to look at, well, is there loss of access? Yes. Is there loss of traffic? Yes. Then you have to look at the circuity of travel. Now, from our position, I would say that the proof of the pudding is in its taste. And the proof of circuity of travel is in the outcome here. The government aimed to take these businesses out, and it worked. Every business out there closed within 3 months, except one business whose primary source of profit is delivery. Its customers don't come to it. It goes to its customers. But outside of that, the purpose, the planning worked. The plan worked just as intended. Those businesses are closed and those non-conforming uses are gone. So I believe circuity of travel, to the extent that the destruction of these businesses is relevant to the issue of security of travel, I believe it almost becomes self-proving at that level. But that does go to the question of whether or not summary judgment is appropriate, if that is a factual determination which must be decided at the trial court.
Also, were you alleging that under the damages terms of the Constitution or the taking, outright taking?
Both. Count one alleged damages under Article 6, Section 13, and count two alleged taking.
Okay.
So we alleged in both directions that we believe and continue to maintain this was a taking, it was intended to take. But it is also a damage and intentional damage provision as required, as set forth under Bolin and Hurley.
So did, but the trial court doesn't make any reference to Hurley.
No, the trial court's decision turned entirely on Darnall. And we believe that that's an error for this main reason. In Darnall, you had a road that never existed before. New road comes in. So people just start using that road instead of Highway 14 and 79. Traveling public is gone. Analogy would be if they put in exit 67, but left in exit 66, then Darnall probably applies, and I think we lose.
It's although even in Darnall, there was an element of reasonableness that needed to be discussed, which was not discussed by the trial court in this case.
That's true.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
I have one question for him. If there's damages to your client, and for the purposes of argument, we'll assume that, explain to me how those damages to your client are peculiar and unique as required, as I understand.
The damage to the traveling public is essentially their inability to reach our businesses. What is peculiar about the loss to our business is the same as in any access case. It is depriving us of the ability to reach that traveling public through the connecting facilities which we are entitled to.
Can the homeowners in Box Elder claim that the value of their property has been diminished now because of the access closing? Now they have to go farther east in order to get on the interstate or farther west?
Your Honor, my gut impression is that for what is reasonable access in a residential setting is different than what is reasonable access in a commercial setting. And I guess my answer is I don't know. My gut tells me that because there are a lot of people who intentionally seek residences away from roads, off of roads, and off common byways that know they're not, but I'm afraid I haven't given that much thought.
Sabres has more questions.
Great. How
we don't
is
take
this
out of your time.
How is this damage unique and peculiar to your client? Any different than to the other commercial places that are right along the road?
It is not. I believe that McDonald's can maintain this same action. I believe that the Taco John's that was there can maintain this same action.
Has the statute of limitations run now so that this would, or would they, a reversal of this case permit all of them to bring actions on the same basis? If you're right on the peculiarity.
Yeah. Justice Sabres, because the statute was never an issue in this case, my general recollection is that an inverse condemnation action is like an impaired property claim. Statute may be 21 years. My guess would be no, but I haven't looked at the statute of limitations issue in this particular case.
Thank you.
I have one quick one. Does this apply? Is our ruling going to apply to everybody that's in this APZ Zone 1?
I would say that it would, and I know that telephone calls I've received, this isn't in the record, telephone calls I've received from McDonald's corporate counsel is they believe it will as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hurd. Mr. Blazer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice. I think maybe what I might do is respond to the question on Lingle first and certainly take questions as you seem appropriate. I think the answer to the Lingle question you raised is, does purpose go away? What the court said in Lingle was that specific test of substantially, the heightened scrutiny really, of substantially relating to the public purpose is no longer an independent takings test. But what it did say is that the default test that we go to now is the Penn Central case test, which is the various factors of economic impact, character of the government action, and interference with distinct investment-backed expectations. So the court basically said, we don't have a bright-line test anymore in terms of what came out of Agins. What we do have is a default test, which is fact-specific. We need to look at the economic impact. And the Hurley case has the same language. I was struck by reading Hurley carefully that the court says you may have a police power action, but in fact it may in fact ultimately be compensable because it goes too far. And what the court is saying, echoing Justice Holmes and the Mahon case and of course Penn Central, is that the police power can be used in such a way that it essentially circumvents the need to compensate. And when that happens, you go too far and in fact you have a taking. So Lingle doesn't really have anything to bear on whether in fact you would here conclude that the purpose is wrong, given the fact that what the state did was say, we intend to damage this property, but we're going to basically couch this in transportation terms. But in fact, we know from the record, and I think the record is quite clear, that the purpose here was to damage and put that property out of use.
Well, then, how do you respond to the state's argument that the Penn Central line of cases has really never addressed a traffic case like this, and Penn Central doesn't apply?
I think, as I suggested, both Hurley, I think, and Darnall both have language that echoes exactly what the court has said in Penn Central, which is that they don't have a set formula for determining when, in fairness and justice, economic injury caused by government action, not necessarily regulation, but action, here we have action, requires just compensation. And instead of simply burdening the few individuals disproportionately, which is what happened here in the case of the Flying J. The point I think also to emphasize and to make sure we're clear on is that there is a property right here at issue, and that again is very much recognized in Darnall and in Hurley, which is the right of the abutting property owner to have access to that highway. And the Hyde case, which also is a case referred to in Hurley, says you have the right to extend reasonably beyond the premises for having reasonable controlling access facilities to the highway. And that's what makes it unique to the abutting property owner, and it's what gives it value, extra value, and it can't be extinguished without paying compensation. You have to start with that property right. The state has suggested we simply want a right, or believe we have a right, in the interstate. We've never claimed that to be the case. The Darnall case, as Mr. Hurd indicated, had a separate highway established, and in fact that property owner, who still had the exact same highway parallel to them, the old one, certainly had no rights to the new highway. Here we had a cutting off totally of any access to the highway to which they already had access rights. And when you have that existing property right, and the Hurley case recognizes that as a matter of South Dakota law, then you can't extinguish that without paying just compensation. And that's the essence of this case. It is not a matter of we have a right to a certain flow of traffic. We have a property right. The other point I think that is important to emphasize is that when we talk about the issue of how do you go about judging impairment, I think that was another question the court raised, you have to look at whether this has been substantially impaired, and the answer is they have no access whatsoever. They have been substantially impaired. And if we go again to your sister state, I think North Dakota is very helpful in looking at the factors that lead to one judging whether you've had substantial impairment. And you do look at circuity of travel and the extent to which that's led to loss of business and loss of traffic. And in this case, you have those factors very much at play, and it's reasonable to look at that. But I'm struck by the fact that the Hurley case gives you the rule of law to apply to the facts that you have in this case. This is not requiring jurisprudence from outside the state to resolve this case. Darnall is very distinguishable.
Wouldn't Hurley, though, require a remand for some fact determinations?
It may, Your Honor. I think that we are asking, and I think it's possible to rule, again, based on Hurley, that as a matter of law, the deprivation of that property right, which is pertinent to the property, of access to the highway, is a taking for which just compensation is required. Arguably, you go back to the circuit court for determination of just compensation. If you do not find that, then the alternative would be to go back to the circuit court, use the Bowen factors of circuity of travel, loss of business, loss of traffic.
We have no findings of fact on any of those issues that you just spoke to.
Well, I think you have, in the Hurley case, a determination that, in fact, the property right, that no one questions the property, the factual circumstance of the Flying J's access to that highway. And when you deprive them of that, as a matter of law, that is a taking. That is what we're urging here before the court. That's consistent with Hurley, you can make that conclusion and reach that determination. You don't need a fact finding for that purpose. And it's on the face of just that taking of that right of access, that is a substantial impairment. It cut off the oxygen to that business. It is now a dead business. I don't think there's anything in the record that would contradict that. In fact, you can amply find from the record that's exactly what the state intended to do and accomplished. The other point I think I want to make, to the extent we look beyond case law, if we look at expectancies, one of the things that the U.S. Supreme Court has helped us understand is that you can develop expectancies in a property right and develop that as a property right for which compensation is required when, in fact, the government allows something to happen. One of the arguments the state has made is, well, this is an access-controlled highway, and state law says you don't have a right to an access-controlled highway. We would agree, but the statute also says that the state may provide points of access, and when, in fact, the state does do that, then, in fact, you do have that property right, and you have that expectancy. In the Kaiser v. Aetna case, you had a situation where you had a marina that made a connection to the bay, to the ocean. The Army Corps of Engineers said, we want you now to give access to the public to that. And the court said, the Supreme Court, Justice Rehnquist writing this, said, well, we don't agree that they have to give public access without paying for it. Why? Because the state, in this case the state, in that case the federal government, decided to allow that access, to allow that connection, and once they do that, expectancies are there. And the court said that is a property right for which compensation is to be found. And notice, this is not a regulation per se. This is simply an action by the government. And I think it's important that we remember that the concept here is government action, not getting caught up in the semantics of regulation per se. It's simply a buzzword that has come into our lexicon of the takings jurisprudence, but by and large, what we really mean is government can act in many ways, as Mr. Hurd indicated, using the police power, using the taxing power, using eminent domain. But when it uses police power to achieve an end that, in fact, eminent domain is intended for, then it should pay compensation.
So do the does Penn Central apply or doesn't it?
It definitely applies, Your Honor, but I would say that Hurley essentially articulates the Penn Central factors, at the idea that you can have a police power action that goes too far and requires compensation. There's no set formula here in the context of transportation. You first have to find the property right. I don't think there's any question that we realize that's the discipline that's required here. But your own case law recognizes that this access to the highway was there, is there. It gives special value to that property. It's what distinguishes it from the rest of the public's access to the highway through other areas. This is an access point that has value, gives value to that property. Then the question is, should they, is compensation due? And your own Hurley case says, if in fact you're going to distinguish that right, that you should pay for it. The Penn Central factors become very relevant because you look at economic impact. There's no question that it was this property, the Flying J, on I think it's October 20th of 2003, was hit by this change, and within 3 weeks their businesses, their fuel, diesel fuel was down by 82%, the gasoline by 50%, and the store down by 28%. They went out of business in 3 weeks. So economic impact is no question about that. The investment in backed expectations, there's no question as well that the Flying J expected and had expectancy, and even in the land use study, it acknowledges that an interchange is a magnet for business.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Ms. Engel, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice and counsel, I'd like to begin by responding to what Mr. Blazer just told you. And that is, he told you, the first step that this court must take in deciding this case is deciding whether there is a property right. He's absolutely correct. and whether there is a property right is a question of law for the court to decide. We don't even get to the question of whether access is reasonable until we first decide what is the property right that they are claiming. Now, let's talk about what South Dakota cases say about access, because they're telling this court that they have a right of access to that interchange at Interstate 90. And our court has said that landowners, abutting landowners, have a reasonable right of access to a conventional highway. That's found in Darnell. And then if you look to Hurley, you'll see that the Hurley court gave effect to that right of access of an abutting landowner who had had access to two city streets, Omaha Street and West Boulevard. And then when the interstate came through, the state sought to acquire their right of access to West Boulevard, a conventional city street. And the court said that the state must pay for that right of access, again, to a conventional highway. What do we have here? The undisputed fact is, and the landowners don't dispute this, that this was a controlled access facility. And under our statutes, the government retains the right to decide who has access to that facility or not. By statute, we are given the authority to acquire those rights of access from the abutting landowners through purchase, devise, condemnation, or I forget the other one, but it's not implicated here. They have never presented to this record that that property right was not properly acquired when this interstate was established. They never disputed that.
Is it in the record that the interstate was constructed before the truck stop?
I don't know that that was in the record.
It doesn't make a difference.
Well, it would if we hadn't acquired that control of access. But it is in the record that Interstate 90 is a controlled access facility, and they have never disputed that.
I don't recall that those statutes were enacted, those two.
The controlled access facility statutes were enacted in 1953. And that's an important point, Justice Zinner, because they bring up the Hyde case, and they try to suggest to you that the Hyde case creates a right of access to the interstate regardless of the fact that it was a controlled access facility. And they point to some dicta in the Hyde case where the court said that you have a right to access to reasonable facilities of the rest of the system of streets. And that's certainly true. What we have to remember about the Hyde case, it was written in 1912, long before controlled access facilities were contemplated. In addition, the actual facts of the Hyde case and the actual ruling suggest contrary to what they would have you believe today. The Hyde case said that the landowner who wanted to connect their abutting street with other streets didn't have a claim of a compensable taking because there were still other routes that they could have taken. Now, I want to talk again about this reasonableness idea.
Before you do, go ahead.
I just want to find out exactly if the state agrees that the purpose here was to put these businesses out of business, to have them go out of business at that location, whether that was an agreed, undisputed fact, and whether you also, it's an undisputed fact that this, it was a substantial impairment.
They used the word purpose, and I believe they're overreaching when they do that. What the record reflects...
So, in my understanding, then, the state does not agree with that.
Well, I think what the record...
Because if it's a summary judgment, there's got to be some undisputed facts here, and I'm still having trouble figuring out what the undisputed facts are.
Well, are you saying there are facts in dispute, Your Honor?
I'm asking, yes.
I don't believe there are any pertinent facts in dispute, and of course, that's the standard for a summary judgment motion. And I say that for several reasons. First of all, they try to suggest that the state's purpose was to put businesses out of business. That's not quite accurate. And I think it's undisputed that the state's purpose was to keep from sending people into the accident potential zone. There was a health and safety concern. But certainly, and I will concede, that the state acknowledged that a consequence of that action of changing that interstate. A consequence of that would likely be that these businesses would be terribly affected and may very well go out of business. That's certainly a legitimate decision for the government to make. And in the Penn Central case, the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledges government could hardly act at all if they could only act when no one would be adversely affected at all.
But doesn't that then suggest that there should have been testimony presented and that the trial court should have taken testimony, taken perhaps all of these reports rather than pieces and bits of them that were attached to the briefs, and actually made findings of fact?
No, Your Honor. And the reason
there's a dispute here on the purpose.
But the purpose is irrelevant to the question that was before the trial court on cross motions by both parties. And the question that was before the trial court was there a property interest that was taken? That was the issue before the court. And the motivation in the government's mind does neither confer a benefit or not confer a benefit. Whatever the motivation was doesn't affect whether a property right was involved here.
Well, wait a minute, though. If the government's purpose is to relocate a business, that's certainly a taking.
It can be used as a public purpose to relocate it for health and safety reasons. But the first question you have to decide in a takings case is whether there's a property right at all. And whatever our motivation was would not affect whether there was a property right.
But Hurley says there can be. That denial of access is a property right.
I agree. Denial of access is a property right when you're dealing with a conventional highway, which was what was at issue in Hurley. Hurley did not involve a controlled access facility where the government validly exercised its right to control access.
So if I understand you right, you're saying that all the way along the interstate, from Rapid to Sioux Falls, the government could come along and close every controlled access to the interstate that they wanted to. They could close down the access to Mitchell, they could close down to Mount Vernon, they could close down to Plankinton, they could close down to Salem, and every other town along the way, and nobody has lost a thing, nobody has any right of action.
You still have to have a reasonable connection to the other facilities along the highway, but to claim a right, which is what the landowners are claiming, they're claiming a right to that specific interchange. And there's evidence in the record that there was another interchange constructed a mile up the road, and there was another interchange 3 miles away. So this isn't a case where
so you're saying they could. You're saying they can. They can close any interstate they want to, and they can do it. They can do it with immunity.
No, what I'm saying is, Your Honor, they don't have any special right to that specific interchange, and that's really what you were asking Mr. Blazer and Mr. Hurd in their direct argument. They have to show a peculiar injury. They have to show a property right that was different in kind and degree from the general public in order for their
trial court never even got to that.
That's right, and they didn't.
There were no findings in that.
And they didn't need to do that, Your Honor, because whether or not they have a property right is a question of law, and it was their burden to come forward and establish for the court why they had a special claim to that specific interchange, and they failed to do that. In fact, they have never disputed the status of this highway as a controlled access facility. So,
did the trial court actually, in the order that the trial court entered, is that the reason the trial court gave that they didn't have a property right? I don't recall that.
The actual order says that their motion for summary judgment is denied, and our motion for summary judgment was granted. And the issue that was brought in each motion was whether there had been a taking as a matter of law.
So the property right was never specifically stated anywhere. That's your argument today, that's what the trial court based it on. But we don't know that that's what the trial court based the decision on, do we?
Well,
the trial court says Darnell. It talks about Darnell.
Right, and the argument that was made by both parties, and I think that's undisputed, is The landowner was claiming a right of access, and the state was arguing that there was no right of access. And the court agreed with the state that it was a question of law and that the landowners had not established any special right of access to that property. That what they were complaining about was the government's regulation of traffic within its own right-of-way. And that, of course, is what our court has talked about in both the Darnell case and also the Henriksen case. The Darnell court said the government has the right to decide and regulate the flow of traffic within the highway right-of-way. And so the government can impose one-way streets, restrict left turns, prohibit U-turns. It can control how traffic moves within its right-of-way. And then in Henriksen, the court reiterated that when they said the government has the right to install a median, and even though it will restrict left turns into a landowner's property, the government has the right to restrict the flow of traffic within its right-of-way. That's exactly what was done here.
Let me say, just a minute, though, you know, Darnell, Henriksen, and Hurley all involve traffic cases. And here we have a case where I think the record's pretty clear. They moved the exit because of the jeopardy to the base. And that fact or that purpose just isn't present in the other cases.
But when you talk about the jeopardy to the base, Your Honor, we also have to look at why the base was in jeopardy. And the record is clear that what drove that economic concern was the safety concern. We're
talking about safety from traffic. It wasn't safety from traffic or access. It was safety from businesses operating independently in APZ1.
But the safety concern for the Department of Transportation as the owner of that interstate was actually facilitating the movement of traffic into that area. And the landowners talk about the loss of that traffic, that they no longer have that traffic going directly by their property, and the loss of that convenient access to all those people going by their business. Those people are still going by. It's just not, they're not directed into that APZ zone. And I would argue that it would be monumentally irresponsible for the government to facilitate the movement of traffic into an area that is regarded as a danger. And that was the public safety concern that was at issue there. But getting back to this idea of regulating traffic, they talk about how Penn Central applies. But Penn Central is always applied when there's been some restriction on the use of someone's property. We never touched their property. We never regulated their property. What property were we regulating? Our own right-of-way, the interchange, and the highway that we own. We're responsible for controlling how traffic moves in that right-of-way, just as was done in Darnell, just as was done in Henriksen.
But what about the difference in the South Dakota Constitution from the United States Constitution in that we recognize the compensability of damages?
In the Hyde case, Your Honor, the court said that damages and taking are the same. And so I don't think that gets the landowners any farther. And even if it did, property rights are defined by state law. And our state law says that the government can acquire the right of access and then can control that right of access. There is no evidence in this record that they retained any access rights to the interchange or the interstate when the government acquired that property. They have never come forward with any reservation in the deed. There is no separate agreement whereby we agreed to provide the interstate in that location. And I'd like to direct the court specifically to pages 9 and 10 of the landowner's reply brief, because there are significant admissions in those provisions. On pages 9 and 10, they acknowledge that a controlled access facility allows the government to control who has access and where. And they even say that no landowner could have insisted on exit 66 being placed where it was. Then they go on to say that the government has the right to discontinue an interchange access. I certainly agree with that. Where we part ways is that they go on to say that over time, by the existence of that interchange, they acquired a property right. That's found on page 10 of their brief. And if I may step aside from the podium for a moment. On page 10 of their brief, we finally get to how it is they claim a right of access to a controlled access facility. And they say, quote, over time, the reasonable access to the interstate provided by Exit 66 Interchange came to constitute an important stick in the bundle of property rights that were appurtenant to the properties in the area. What is the legal theory that they are presenting to this court when they say, by the existence of the interchange over time, they somehow acquired a property right?
Isn't that what Darnell says? It says, once a highway is built and access is provided, abutting property owners have the right of access, and that's a separate property right which cannot be extinguished without just compensation.
That's to a conventional highway, Your Honor. And I believe Darnell even uses the term conventional highway. But I have to emphasize to this court, this is not a conventional highway. What they are suggesting to you is that after the government acquired the right of access to this property, it could lose it by letting the public use the property. That's a prescriptive easement theory. You cannot claim a prescriptive easement against the state. In addition, if you want to assert a prescriptive easement, your use has to be exclusive to that of others. This interchange was used by the public. That's why it was valuable to them. Finally, to establish a prescriptive easement, you have to establish that use was not by permission. And here, we of course allowed all of the public the use of that property. And that circles back, Justice Sabers, to your questions earlier. They have to show a peculiar injury. They have to show that they surrendered something different, both in kind and degree, than the general public. They did not. All of the public was allowed to use this interchange. Allowed because the government made a determination.
But doesn't that have to be a finding? Then wouldn't we have to send it back for the trial court to take evidence on that?
No, Your Honor.
So that's an undisputed fact that it was, I mean, you're arguing something different than they are arguing, so it's got to be disputed.
No, Your Honor. You know, it's difficult to present evidence on a fact that was never disputed before the trial court. But in our affidavit in support of our motion for summary judgment, we asserted this is a controlled access facility, and they never disputed that. In fact, they don't dispute that here. But what they're trying to do.
But whether or not their damages were peculiar, or if they damaged differently, that's got to be. I mean, that's not in the record, is it?
They've got to come up with the property right in the first instance, Your Honor. They agree that they, as part of a takings analysis, you have to start with the property right. And whether there's a property right is a question of law. What additional facts have they identified for you that is going to establish that over time they acquired a right of access to a controlled access facility? There are none. They had their opportunity to spin this prescriptive easement theory before the trial court. After all, they were bringing the same motion that we were. They didn't make any of those arguments before the trial court. Now, months later, they stand before this court and ask you on this vague assertion that we must have something here, Your Honors, that you should send this back and give them a second shot.
I
can't agree.
Do you concede that North Ellsworth Road is a conventional road?
Yes, and I would also concede, Your Honor, that use of North Ellsworth Road is unchanged. They still connect both to Interstate 90 and to the other system of streets. It's just more circuitous. And of
course, it's not unchanged then. I mean, you're saying it's changed in a different manner. You're not, it is changed.
There's
no access to 66 anymore.
They lost access to a controlled access facility. Yes.
Right.
The connection between that road and a controlled access facility is no longer there. But they have to show a special property right to that connection, and they failed to do that.
Okay, thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Hurd, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry?
I was just wondering, she spent a good part of her time talking about the difference where you have an interstate controlled access highway. We didn't hear much of that in your presentation. Is there a difference?
Well, I don't see one in the law. There's no law that says that. I mean, I do agree that there are a couple places in some of these cases where the word conventional appears. But the state has read that word to mean that the entire body of access law that has always existed has no application to interstate exits or interstate highways. But more to the point is I think that the argument becomes a little bit circuitous. If I understand it right, I think she begins with the proposition that there is absolutely no right of access. It can be taken, given away. The investment-backed expectations analysis does not apply. The analysis of the Boehm decision about whether or not you invested there or built there because there was an exit there, none of that applies. We can take them on at Mitchell, at Sioux Falls, we can put them on and off any place in the state. When asked, she said, well, no, because they still have exit 67, and so that's reasonable. Well, of course, that's the issue, isn't it? That gets us back to what the real loss of access issue is, and that is, do you have reasonable access? As Justice Meyer Henry, you requested, well, where do we find in the record that it's undisputed that the access either is reasonable or is not reasonable? As I said in my opening argument, our proposition and thesis is pretty easy on that. The fact that we were put out of business means it's not reasonable. If the court does not want to adopt that as a proposition of law, but believes that that's the kind of thing which would require further factual development, the case should be remanded to the circuit court for a trial on that issue. Purpose. The first question is whether or not the purpose is safety. Well, in the transcript of the hearing, the court will note that the state agreed it argued that if the Air Force hadn't been threatening to put Ellsworth on the base closure commission, they would not have pulled exit 66. The idea that it was done for the safety of the traveling public and to keep them out of the APZ simply is not borne out in the record. But if that were true, that would require further factual development. So then the question is this, is purpose important? Because Hurley says that you have to balance the interests of the state. We want Ellsworth Air Force Base open versus the interests of the private individual. Should my clients have to pick up the tab for the millions of dollars it's going to cost to keep Ellsworth open for the economic benefit of everyone? Should they bear the weight of that benefit? Because the Hurley case specifically says you look at what's the public interest, what's the private interest, and they have to be balanced. Purpose is relevant. Purpose is relevant. The only question here is if the court believes that there is not enough on the record to decide as a matter of law that the purpose was that the exits were removed for the purpose of taking the property and rendering it economically unuseful, which would be a taking by definition, then again the case should be remanded to the trial court for a determination on that matter.
What was the basis on which you moved for summary judgment?
That was the basis. I moved on the basis that if the state acts to render property useless, that's the reason they do it, they can't come up with a tricky mechanism by which to deprive the landowner of compensation in the doing of that. The joint land use study specifically says we're looking at how to do this without paying eminent domain. We think we can do it because if you yank out the exit 66, those businesses will have to move.
And you think there's no genuine issue of material fact in relation to that motion for summary judgment?
I don't believe that there is. I mean, obviously, you have access to what we submitted were our statements of undisputed fact. We've got the deposition testimony of Dennis Langiff, and I apologize ahead of time, I'm going to murder this, Leon Schachemeyer. And both of them agreed. Yeah, we were with the DOT. The reason we went in and pulled those out was because we're trying to get rid of the non-conforming uses off Ellsworth's North Runway.
Tell me about the controlled access statutes before your time expires.
tell you about the controlled access statutes?
Right, that appear to give no right of access.
I would agree that we could not compel Exit 66 to be built, and I also agree that we cannot prevent necessarily Exit 66 from being removed so long as you continue to provide us reasonable access to I-90. Now, whether or not
that statute, if enacted in 53, certainly defines the scope of your client's property rights to some extent.
To some extent, certainly we knew that there was always the chance that could be closed, but that's the Bowen versus Bax decision. When you buy, you always know that the government has the right to do certain things that may or may not affect your property. But where that investment, where you make the investment based upon the roads as they exist at that time, and that access is then removed, the question of whether or not there's a taking still turns on loss of traffic, loss of business, and security of travel back to your location.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Blaser, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me focus on two points, perhaps, to further clarify. On this issue of public purpose, I think what's very important is undisputed in the record, because it's in the record as a statement, is in this joint land use study, it says very clearly at pages 1-6, the location of the new interchange is sufficiently spaced from exit 66 to operate safely and efficiently without adversely affecting operations. In other words, both interchanges could have remained and you would not have had any safety issue. That's in the record, it's very clear, and this is why it's very difficult to make the argument, I think, for the state to say the paramount concern was safety here. Now, on the issue of the controlled access, let's go to pages 9 and 10 of our brief. The quote there is...
So if I'm understanding, what you're saying is that the report said the interchanges weren't the problem with safety.
No need to take them away. No need to take it away. Both interchanges could operate safely. It's very clearly stated in the record, pages 1-6 of the joint land use study. Now, the controlled access statute says, and this is important because the state quotes something that, in fact, has an answer to it. No person shall have any rights of ingress or egress to or from across controlled access facilities or to or from abutting lands. And then here's the key point, except as such designated points at which access may be permitted upon such terms and conditions as may be specified. They gave us access. There's no question that, in fact, we have access. This is the property right that Hurley has said cannot be extinguished without, in fact, paying compensation. Now, the state goes on to suggest that they can take it away at any time without any consequence. We didn't say that in our brief. They suggested we acquiesce to that point. What we said is the statute provides that the state may permit access to controlled access facilities, which carries an implied authorization that the state can determine that access at a particular point should be discontinued. However, this authorization is irrelevant to the question before this court whether the state and federal constitutions require payment of just compensation for the deprivation of a property right. So we do come back to the same point again. Did you have a property right? Yes, you did, on the basis of having been given that access. If we had never been given access, we wouldn't be arguing this here. But when you have a controlled access highway, I think as Mr. Hurd also indicated, it doesn't mean that the state can do whatever it wishes without any consequence. It has given us that access. And it's very important to recognize, and this is why I mentioned the Kaiser Aetna case as a way to analyze this case, not only do you have a property right under the Hurley case, but to the extent that you're wondering whether the controlled access case situation has any import for how you might look at this case, by the terms of the statute itself, it provides for giving you an access, and there's an expectancy that does build up to a property right, even apart from what the Hurley case says under South Dakota law. So whether you look at federal constitutional law or whether you look at state law, there's a property right for which just compensation, if it's going to be extinguished, must be paid. That's very important, and the state, I think, brushes by that and suggests that there's no property right that, in fact, has a consequence when it's taken. The Hendrickson case, which the state mentions, I think is very distinguishable. It simply was an interchange where they reduced access to the property by leaving only one curb cut. Well, you still had access. Here we have access totally cut off. They cut off the business, made it impossible to continue. So Hendrix is very distinguishable. If you just reduce the ability to get there in terms of the traffic flow to some extent, that's different. Here we have circuity of travel in spades. We have to go a mile down in order to get to the Flying J. There's no way that business can survive under those circumstances. Is there another point in the record I can help clarify? Because I don't want to just go on without being helpful to the court here on what the state has said. I'm not sure there's much else to rebut. I think we are in agreement on the fact that the property right is the starting point. I don't think the state can get around the fact that there is a property right under South Dakota law. We are not arguing that we have a right in the interchange. We're arguing we have an appurtenant right to access to the highway. Whether you call it controlled or conventional, it's still a right of access. You can't take it away without paying for it. And when the court is going all the way back to the jurisprudence in Jacob Taking, says that when government tries to accomplish something in a short circuit way without paying for it, then you have a constitutional violation. And the South Dakota Supreme Court and the South Dakota Constitution are very much on all four squares with the U.S. Constitution in that regard. You can't accomplish something by using one means to get at what, in fact, you should otherwise pay for with just compensation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Blizzard. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.